If you're still waiting for a sign, here's another one. At California Psychics, we reject 98% of the psychics who apply to work for us. So we only connect you with the best. That's how we can guarantee if your reading isn't life-changing, it's free. And right now, new customers receive 20 minutes for just $20. If that's not a sign, I don't know what is. Dramatic sound effect incoming. Experience the joy of certainty at CaliforniaPsychics.com.
It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
It is indeed episode 516 of Rico Bronya. On today's edition of the Rico Bronya, we will talk about the shocking come-from-behind victory that the Mets put together on Monday night against the Angels, but we will spend most of our time analyzing what David Stern said at his press conference. Now, remember, David Stern meets the media during every homestand. Sometimes we pay less attention to it. Sometimes we pay a lot of attention to it. But David has actually been very good at speaking to us as fans and the media at least one point during every homestand. Doesn't always happen at the beginning of the homestand. In this case, it's the middle of the homestand. But when he met the media on Monday, before Monday's game against the Angels, smack in the middle of this Reds Angels homestand, he spoke about two topics: the return of Francisco Alvarez, prior to him actually having a great return, which he drew two walks and had a huge double and played good defense, and also the trade deadline. So what we will do, and we've done this before on the Rico, is we will listen to every question that David was asked. We will listen to every answer David gave, and we will give you our reactions to what he said. We did that a lot during the offseason. It takes a while. So strap up, baby. But before we get to David Stearns, how about some thoughts on game one of this series against the Angels, which I have to admit, and I don't sit while watching Met games ultra negative. I also don't sit there ultra positive. Usually you have a feel for a game. Sometimes it's a good feeling. Sometimes it's a bad feeling. When Kodai Senga didn't have it, and that's the best way to just describe Senga's performance, it was a dud. His command was off, and you could see it right from the get-go. You know, when he got ahead of Zach Neto to start the game and then lost him, I mean, he could not command his ghost fork. He ends up walking Zach Neto, and it turned out to be kind of not a big deal because Senga got the next three guys out. And so, yeah, we've seen Kodai work through trouble before, but it was a sign of things to come. He gives up the home run to Logan Ohapi, but then the third inning was an out-and-out disaster. And some of it was bad luck. I mean, he gives up a little cheap infield hit to Renjifo to start the inning and came very close to striking out Mike Trout to end the third inning. There was a fastball that was a touch off the plate. He also induced a ground ball against Zach Neto that, if the Angels weren't being ultra aggressive by sending Renjifo from first base, is probably a tailor-made 5-4-3 double play. So he came kind of close to getting through that third inning. But once he issued the walk to Mike Trout, it just became a disaster. He gives up the double to Taylor Ward. He gives up the RBI hit to Joe Adell. He walks Yoan Mankato. And then luckily, he struck out Logan Ohapi because it felt as if he was going to have a real tough time even getting through the third inning. But his pitch count just exploded. And you just knew, all right, he's not long for the world. And considering that, while Senga hasn't gone deep into games, and that's probably the best critique one can have of him, he hasn't had a dud. This was really his first dud, and certainly didn't come at the right time because the Mets are coming off losing 2 out of 3 to the Cincinnati Reds. And, you know, in the first few innings of this game, first 3 innings of this game, it felt like, oh my God, they're going to be shut down by Tyler Anderson. So it didn't feel like it was timely, but I was at least able as a fan to say, all right, it happens. I mean, Kodai Senga was not going to go through this season and pitch to a 1.4 ERA. He's not Tom Seaver. He's not Jacob DeGrom. It's not going to happen. He's not Bob Gibson. So it is okay every once in a while for your starter to have a dud. But what I have screamed about before is that even when your starter has a dud performance like Senga had on Monday, you're still allowed to win. You're still allowed to have your bullpen come in and keep the game close, which is exactly what happened. Thank you to Kevin Hergett, who's got a real chance to be the Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series. Even though he's going to be DFA'd, you know, probably by the end of the day. But Kevin Hergett comes in second tour duty with the Mets. I even mocked Kevin Hergett on Evan and Tiki very briefly because you were talking about the Met bullpen and upgrading the Met bullpen. And I name checked him as one of the guys that needs to be replaced The guy got seven huge outs. And at the time, down 4-0, it may not feel like a big deal, but at least you buy time. You give your offense a chance to come back. But outside of Chris Devinsky, who was very shaky, and I thought Mendy screwed up by keeping him in the seventh inning way too long. More on that in a few minutes. But the bullpen kept it close, and it gave this offense a chance, even if we weren't confident it was going to happen, to at least come back in this game. Brett Beatty, who many believe, including Pete, should have been the Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series from the previous series, hit a huge two-run home run. That two-run home run in the fourth inning that took a 4-0 game and a 4-2 was arguably one of the biggest moments of the game. Because at that moment when Beatty goes deep, it's a baseball game. It's a close game. And the pressure's on. You're sitting down 4-0 in the seventh or eighth inning. The odds of you coming back are incredibly low. So huge home run by Brett Beatty. Again, the offense continues to struggle. And then finally, they break through in the seventh inning. We saw a huge walk by Francisco Alvarez, one of the most underrated moments of the game. I think he was behind 0-2 in that sequence as well. A huge base hit by Luis Angel Acuna. So you got the 8 and 9 hitters setting it up for Nimmo, Lindor, and Soto. Nimmo gets hit by the pitch. Lindor, again, doesn't come through, but at least doesn't ground into a double play and does steal second, which sets up the huge Juan Soto two-run single behind in the count to tie the game up. A rare but huge hit by Juan Soto. City Field's electric. They come back and they tie the game. And once they come back and tie the game, my confidence meter was through the roof. Now I believed, all right, they're going to win this game. Even after Alonso struck out and McNeil grounded out to end the seventh inning. And finally, they come back. They win the game. The sack fly by Brandon Nimmo. The fielder's choice ground out by Ronnie Mauricio, and then the terrible throw and the bad catch by Ohapi. Look, sometimes you got to take advantage of other teams' mistakes. Teams have done that to the Mets. The Blue Jays did that to the Yankees the other night. So this wasn't aesthetically pleasing, especially in the way they took the lead. They were helped out by bad Angel defense, and that's okay. I'm not throwing that back. Was this a signature win? Was this a DVD championship win? Probably not, but it was a good win. And then to top it all off, and this was really, really encouraging, to see Edwin Diaz with a two-run lead coming in the ninth inning against the heart of the Angels order and just absolutely dominate. Like, that is so great to see, especially after a rare hiccup from Edwin Diaz. If there was any concern coming off what happened on Sunday with the blown save and the lack of command, he comes in against Chanel, Trout, and Ward, and as the kids like to say, he shoved. Absolutely dominant performance by Edwin Diaz. Really good performance by Brooks Raley, who now in two performances since being activated from the injured list has been great. Waskar Brazoban came in and got two big outs, cleaning up that Devinsky mess in the seventh inning. And that was one of my kind of issues with Mendy in this game real time. Devinsky gets two big outs in the sixth inning. Great. He comes out for the seventh inning, no problem. Gives up a leadoff hit. Alvarez makes a little bit of an offline throw on a stolen base attempt, but luckily, if you're going to be offline, do it right into the runner. So Lindor catches, tags out Neto as the throw is being made for a huge Alvarez caught stealing. But as that's happening, and this is where I take him out, Devinsky walks Chanel on four pitches. At that point, you just put two guys on base in a row. You got lucky that Alvarez threw a guy out. Get him out. Go to Brazoban right there. And instead, Mendy keeps him in to hit Mike Trout, keeps him in again to face Taylor Ward, and gives up the RBI single. I thought he stuck with Devinsky two batters too long. That's my big critique of Carlos Mendoza from Monday night. But let's get to Alvarez. I incorrectly predicted that Alvarez would be called up to begin the series against Cincinnati as we were doing the Rico going into the All-Star break. I was off by a few days, but clearly it was time. It was time because he was performing at AAA. It was time because even though Torrens had a really solid weekend, we know what Torrens is. And I've said this a lot here on the Rico, and I don't mean this as an insult. He's a backup catcher. He's a really good backup catcher. I mean, if I'm power ranking backup catchers in baseball, he's up there because he's so good defensively. He'll occasionally run into the big hit. Like, his numbers statistically this year, I think it's about 215, like 16, 17 RBIs. I would argue watching him every day, if you close your eyes, his offense has probably been even better than what those numbers say. Not that he's a plus offensively, but he's been timely. So I like Terrence, and I like getting him in there. Like, even with Alvarez being called up, I still want Terrence to play a couple of times a week. But it was time to bring up the upside of Francisco Alvarez. When you combine that his defense was very solid in one game, especially the caught stealing, and then the patience. The two walks in this game, especially the walk that started the seventh inning, very good to see. And then the double. Like, in that eighth inning when the Mets scored the two runs to take the 7-5 lead, the biggest hit of that inning was the Alvarez double, even though the right fielder Lamont Wade should have caught it. Or Chris Taylor, I should say. Yes, because Chris Taylor came in, the former Dodger. And so he should have caught it, but the ball was hit 370 feet, and it was ripped the right field. And off the bat, I thought it was getting out. But nevertheless, that hit, which set up second and third one out, was one of the biggest hits of the game, and it was very encouraging to see Alvarez have that kind of return. So really good win by the Mets, half game out of first place. The Giants and the Reds both lost. The reason I bring that up is the priority is making the postseason. And so I'm sitting there now, especially in late July, and I make a change in my scorebook. This is the geeky part of the Rico. There's a standing section. And so I always put East, Central, and West, right? Just your typical standings. After the All-Star break, I change how I put the standings. I put the division leaders. I put the three wildcard teams and then everybody else. And the reason I do that is because to me, after the All-Star break, that's the focus. It's the playoffs. It's where are you seated? So now every night when I fill out my scorecard, I got a great vision of where things stand for the postseason. And right now the Mets have a 5-game lead over just making the playoffs. And that's the priority, because we're going to spend a lot of time here talking about the division and a first-round bye. And yes, I want that stuff. But as we saw last year, just get to the tournament. Get to the tournament and get hot. And that works both ways. You can get to the tournament winning 105 games and not get hot and get knocked out immediately. We kind of saw that with the 2022 New York Mets. And then, of course, you contrast it to last year where you get in on the final day, the after final day, and you go all the way to the NLCS. Good win by the Mets. We'll have another Rico Bronya to recap the series, and we will have a Rico Bronya on Thursday to preview the trade deadline. But let's hear from the president of the New York Mets, David Stearns, who met the media prior to game one of this series against the Angels. He will talk a lot about Francisco Alvarez and a lot about the trade deadline. Let's kick it off from David Stearns.
David, we, you know, obviously just talked to Mendy about this as well, but from an organization's perspective, I know you look at far more than just the home run numbers from Alvarez. So what were you specifically looking for and then saw that told you it was time that he comes back up here?
I think first and foremost, we wanted to see how Alvy was going to respond to the challenge that we gave him when we sent him down. I've seen this go both ways. I've seen players sulk and ask, why is this happening? Why me? And then I've seen players turn the corner and look to get back and look to work and look to work with the instructors in a less pressurized environment. And from day one, when Alvy was there, that's what he did. He worked extremely hard. I think he understood and recognized that the way he was performing at the major league level on both sides of the ball was not who he was. And he took the opportunity away from the bright lights and the cameras and the pressure of a major league environment to work. And he improved very rapidly. This happened faster than I would have envisioned when we optioned him.
Interesting. So I guess he thought this was going to take longer than a month, because it ended up only taking a month for Alvarez to come back. One thing we've heard about Francisco since he came up all the way back in late 2022 is how hard he works. That has been a consistency. You know, there are other prospects. I remember Mark Vientos. One of the rips on him was he wasn't working hard enough. And I don't know if something changed. Obviously it has, because Vientos has worked his tail off over the last couple of years. But Francisco Alvarez has a work ethic, which you obviously need to be a Major League Baseball player, but even more so when you're a catcher. So I'm certainly not surprised by that, but it was great that Alvarez, when he went down to AAA, responded to the challenge of his demotion.
What were those things that you did see that he improved on as rapidly as he did?
It really was all facets of the game. I think we can start offensively. What has made Alvy such a special hitter is the threat of him going deep, of being able to hit the ball incredibly hard, hit it out to all parts of the field, not just pull power, but he can hit balls out to right center, to right field. And we lost that a little bit. And I think part of that was the work and the changes he went through in the offseason combined with an abbreviated spring training and then immediately trying to get back into major league competition, I think was tough. And some of it was just once you get some poor results at the major league level, you can spiral down some rabbit holes. And I think that's what happened. And then defensively, we just wanted him to get back to the fundamentals of who he was as a catcher. He's a very natural athletic catcher, and we may have gotten a little bit too, whether it's mechanical or thinking about every single thing. And if we could get him back to being an athletic, natural catcher, we thought that a lot could improve, and a lot did. I think we saw a better receiver throughout his time in the minor leagues. We saw a better blocker, and both of those things were great to see.
You know what they could have done, and I know this is the ultimate second guess, but Hoff, you even brought this up. You were skeptical about his recovery from the injury. Is they could have used the entire rehab clock, and they used a big portion of it, but then option him. And what would we have said at the time? I think we would have said, hey, what the hell's going on? But I think it would have caused less attention than sending him down after he failed at the major league level. They could have really slowed played his return, knowing the adjustments he was making during the offseason and basically realizing, hey, it's still early in the season. It's late April. It's early May. It's mid-May. Let him continue to kind of not only rehab, but tweak and get used to whatever changes he was making. Instead, the Mets activated him, and he obviously failed. I mean, Alvarez was having a terrible season from both ends, but you talked about the power the other way, David Stearns. We got to see that in his return, as we talked about. And obviously, this was before the game, but the jam or the rip that he had to right field in the eighth inning, like I said, one of the most important hits of the game. I thought it had a chance to get out, and that was the old Alvarez showing power the other way.
David, was there a point in the recent past when you might have thought about Alvy, okay, he's ready, and then gave him an extra week or handful of games or whatever it was to make sure that, you know, you kind of were seeing what you thought you were seeing? Or did you have a time frame in mind where if he hit certain mileposts, he'd be good to go, in your opinion?
There wasn't a time frame. I think, frankly, it accelerated on us the weekend before the break. He had a great weekend before the break, and it seemed like a lot of things on both sides of the ball began to click. And then we had the opportunity internally to discuss it over the All-Star break and made the decision to let's see if we can keep this going for another series and reevaluate after yesterday. And he had a very good weekend. And so it made sense to get him back here now.
I think the other thing, even though David isn't admitting it, is what was happening on the major league roster. Even though Torrens had a good weekend, they're missing this. Like, they're missing that pop and that potential pop that they wouldn't have if Torrens is the everyday catcher.
Did he have or need a period of time when he first went down to kind of come to grips with it? And do you allow that sort of transition period for a player in his situation?
I thought he was going to need that period of time. I expected him to need that period of time, and we were very willing to grant him that period of time. And then he showed up immediately to spring training wanting to get to work. And asking, what can I do? How do I get back? And that was great to see. But yeah, I was expecting, look, players get 72 hours to report to AAA. I was expecting him to take 72 hours, and I would have given him a couple extra days to clear his head if he needed it. And he showed up immediately. So I think he expressed this, I think, when he was down at AAA. He was a little surprised, shocked at first, and then he got to work.
That's a great sign. It's a great sign that he faced the adversity by saying, all right, I'm disappointed, but let me get back to work and get back here. And it took a month, and he's back.
Dave, you kind of answered this a little bit before, but you know, you didn't activate him right after the All-Star break and just start the second half with him. How much of his readiness just happened to coincide with the fact that you guys can use his production at this point? I mean, he's down in the minor leagues, you know, hitting a home run almost every other at bat. Was that had to be part of it, I would imagine, right? Considering where you guys at the
we really do try and tried in this case to make it what's best for the player, because what is best for Alvi in this case long term, and certainly for this year, is going to be best for our team as a whole. So I don't think the timing of this would have changed if we scored 30 runs over the weekend. I think we believe this is the right time. Doesn't mean he's going to hit a home run every day here. And doesn't mean he's going to be perfect behind the plate, but we think he's certainly demonstrated enough improvement that he deserves to be here, and he deserves to get some runway.
See, David Stearns is very careful with his words, where he doesn't want to lie to you, but he's not going to tell you the full truth. So he says, we try to make it about the player. We try to make it about what's best for Francisco Alvarez. You could try all you want, but when your offense is LD, as we like to say around here, limp, yeah, and you got a guy in AAA who's hitting a home run every other game, it's only natural to say, yeah, we want what's best for Alvi, but boy, this would really help our team. So let's meet in the middle, David, and say it was a perfect storm of the Mets offense struggling at the major league level and Alvarez tearing it up at AAA.
You obviously had some shuffling on your infield, especially the bottom half of your order lately. In your mind, is it desirable to, by the end of the season, have more set regulars at second and third and in center?
Not really. I think, look, it's desirable to have players continue to improve. We want to have good players. Ultimately, if you get to really good players or all-star caliber players, then yes, you sort of own your position, and we certainly have some of those on the roster, and so that would be wonderful if someone were to take a step forward and solidify himself as a really good everyday regular. Probably makes Mendy's job a little bit easier to make out the lineup card every day. From a roster construction standpoint, like, we have 26 roster spots, and we want to use them all, and if that means certain positions need to be timeshares, then certain positions will be timeshares.
There's nothing wrong with platoons. Now, obviously, if you don't have set positions because nobody's good enough, which at times has felt like the case this year, that's not ideal. But in terms of, hey, Beatty's going to face every righty, but against lefties, we don't like that matchup as much, and we're going to sit him and play this guy, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. As we sit here in late July, the guy who is earning playing time and is getting it is Brett Beatty. I mean, unless you want to include Jeff McNeil in that, because I know at the beginning of the season, we kind of viewed McNeil as a guy who could lose his second base job. Jeff McNeil playing every day is important. Brett Beatty playing every day is important. The jury kind of remains out on Ronnie Mauricio. Vientos is showing signs of life. So I don't think it needs to be set. You just need guys to be productive. Obviously, that's the most important thing.
And then how have you felt, you know, a couple weeks ago, you said the team defense hadn't been where you wanted it to be. How do you feel about where it is right now?
Yeah. So at times really good. And at times we make mistakes that cost us a little bit. We made a couple mistakes the other night by two pretty good defenders. Like, LT's been really good back there and made a mistake. I think Ronnie's been really good at third base and he made a mistake and we couldn't convert the combination of those two plays really impacted a game. And we tend to notice these things when they don't go well. I think for the most part, over the past couple weeks, we've been a better defensive team than we were previously.
He is right about the fact that, and it's Luis Torrens, David, you will never, ever call him LT. That's almost insulting. And if I'm not mistaken, David grew up as a Giant fan, so I don't know what he's doing with that, but he is right that Torrens has been an A defensively. Even Ronnie Mauricio. I know he was here in the booze on Saturday, but his defense has mostly been pretty good. The reason that miscues like that get blown up is when you lose because your offense does nothing. Like, go back to Monday's game. We opened up this Rico talking about Monday's game. They got a bad starting pitching performance. I mean, there's no other way to put it. Kodai Senga wasn't good. But you're still allowed to win. You're still allowed to overcome it. Bullpen stepped up. Offense stepped up. They won the game. They even had a miscue in this game. Francisco Lindor, who's usually good defensively, made a terrible throw home. You can overcome it. What happened with those two defensive miscues that he referred to by Mauricio and Torrens is that they didn't overcome it. And so when you're walking out of Citi Field or you're shutting off the TV that day, you're thinking about the miscues and how they did you in. But those two guys specifically have been good defensively. Overall, the defense has been disappointing this season, but you expect more out of Luis Torrens, and for the most part, you've gotten it.
Just jumping back to Alvarez, it's easy for us to see how he's doing offensively. You see the home runs on the highlights and everything like that, but you also mentioned you saw improvements from him behind the plate. Can you specify what exactly did you see from him that he improved?
Yeah, I think the improvements behind the plate, frankly, were maybe more important for us to see than the offensive improvements. He immediately got to work on his receiving and blocking, and both of those were materially better, especially over the last, I'd say, week to 10 days in AAA than what we had seen previously.
Yeah, that's the thing we couldn't tell. We see the numbers. We see the stats. How's he looking defensively? One game into his major league return, defense was fine, including that big caught stealing.
Just with the trade deadline approaching, just you guys have run into some bad luck. Five guys, season-ending surgeries on the pitching staff. What are some areas that you are looking to perhaps improve as we get there?
I think, first of all, we will improve our team. We like upgrades everywhere. And so I think we cast a pretty wide net and we'll continue to do so. Specifically, you touched on we've been hit with injuries in the pitching staff. I think specifically the bullpen. And so we will be active there. And I think providing our group some reinforcements in the bullpen would be great. They're generally relievers traded at the deadline. And so I'm sure there will be some this as well, and we'll be involved in that. I think if, ideally we'd find deals that we think make sense, bring guys in who we think can help us. If that doesn't happen for some reason, then, we probably have to begin to think about some of the arms at AAA and whether those guys at some point can impact us in the bullpen. The challenge with doing that in season is once you do that, you can't reverse yourself in the same season. We can certainly reverse ourselves over the offseason, but once we shorten someone up to give them a chance to be a member of our pen, really tough to build them back up if you need them as a starter. And so we want to be very cautious if we're going to entertain that.
I have to admit, and it's very, very risky, and you can do both. I'll be the first to tell you, both can happen. I love, or love is not the right word. I am very intrigued by taking Brandon Sproat, by taking Nolan McLean, by even taking Jonathan. Why not? Even though he's at AA, and saying, all right, we're going to move you to the bullpen in September. We're going to let you fire it out for an inning or two, because we've seen in the past how successful that can be. We saw that from the Yankees with Jabba Chamberlain and Phil Hughes. We saw that with Texas. I don't know how many people remember this, but Neftali Feliz was a starting pitching prospect, and they moved him to the bullpen. Now, the deal we have to make as Met fans is, let's say they take Nolan McLean. Let's use him as an example. And they say, we're going to put you out of the bullpen. We're going to pitch you in the sixth, seventh inning, let you dominate, let you throw a little bit harder because you're not going to have to extend through a game. And let's say he's great. And let's say the Mets kind of formulate a super bullpen with some, if not just one, of their young starting pitching prospects. We all need to make a deal that it's temporary and that next year they move back into the rotation. Because I lived this in my early days of WFAN with Jabba. I was one of the few that wanted Jabba to return to the rotation because I'm like, yeah, he was great. Yeah, he was amazing. But wouldn't you rather have a really good starter than a really good bullpen arm? So if the possibility still exists that this guy can turn into a top of the rotation arm, wouldn't you at least try to find out if that's the case? But I am intrigued by that. Now, the good news is, let's say the Mets go out and add a reliever or two. They can still take a Nolan McLean and say, you know what? Let's see if this guy can be a weapon out of the bullpen. I wouldn't want to do that stuff until September because of what David even mentioned, like keep open the possibility that they could start, especially if there's another injury or two. Like right now, the Mets have this kind of, they've got a thin line when it comes to rotation depth. Like they have a rotation right now. Kodai Senga, Sean Manaea, David Peterson, Frankie Montas, Clay Holmes. And it's like, okay, that's good. But where's the depth? Paul Blackburn is coming back, but no one's in love with Paul Blackburn. Tylor Megill, I haven't even heard an update on. Griffin Canning obviously isn't walking through that door. So the Mets starting pitching depth right now is their youth. Or it's using a freaking opener, which we all hate. But that answer by David Stearns basically tells you we are going to be aggressive trying to improve this bullpen. Now, there's two layers to this. Are you going to be aggressive trading for Emmanuel Class A? Or are you going to be aggressive trading for lottery tickets like you did last year, the likes of Ryan Stanek, Phil Maton, Waskar Brazoban? If I had to guess, and I don't think anyone's going to like this answer, I think it's more the latter. I think it's more a trade deadline with relievers very similar to last year, where you're bringing in a couple of relievers, some of which are not even having great years, with the hope of, hey, let's a lottery ticket. And it sort of worked last year. If we're being fair, Maton was good in the regular season, really struggled a little bit in the playoffs, and Stanek turned out to be one of their more reliable pitchers in the postseason. So as we sit here a year later, you'd have to admit it wasn't exactly a disaster.
Along the same lines, trade deadline, to what extent, if at all, do you feel like this team needs a major addition, like one of those quote-unquote big splashes, versus maybe something more along the lines of what you did last year, plugging holes around the roster?
Yeah, I try not to look at it as the size of the splash. I think that can get a little dangerous this time of year if we focus too much on the size of the splash. I think we try to look at it as, like, how good is the player coming back, and how does that particular player fit the team needs. And so I also don't know how many big splash players are actually going to get traded at this deadline.
Bingo.
I think that remains to be seen a little bit. So we'll see. We got 10 days to go. There are still a number of teams that are trying to figure out where they are. And my guess is we will have a little bit more clarity on some of this, 6-7 days from now, with then 3 days leading into the deadline.
I mean, that's the answer. Who is a big splash right now? Like, who would qualify as a big splash? If I had to tell you that answer off the top, I think there are two guys that jump out at me as big splashes. And we'll go into more detail on Thursday with our trade deadline, Rico. And they're both relievers, Johan Duran and Emmanuel Clase. Those are the guys, the two top closers in the American League Central, who could be traded. We don't even know for sure if they're going to be traded, because they don't need to be traded. Like, they don't have to. Duran isn't a free agent until 2028. So if you're the Minnesota Twins, you got this 27-year-old top closer. You don't have to trade him. Now, you can if you get some kind of King's ransom back, but there's no rush to do it. Same thing in Cleveland with Emmanuel Class A. But I would argue, of the guys that are realistically available, those are the biggest splashes. Those deals would excite us the most, because it would form a super bullpen. Now, there'd be an adjustment, because you'd be asking Duran and Class A to become eighth inning guys, essentially. But is Suarez a big splash? Is Zach Gallen or Merrill Kelly a big splash? Is Sandy Alcantara a big splash? I kind of agree with David. I don't know if there's a big splash available.
You mentioned pitching. What is your appetite or desire level to add offensively?
You know, I look at our position player grouping, and for the most part, I'm pretty pleased with where we are. I think our younger players have taken a step forward. When we're talking about Brett Beatty and Ronnie Mauricio, both those guys have contributed. Positionally, the one position where we haven't gotten the level of production that we probably anticipated coming into the year is center field. And I don't think I'm saying anything that's going to surprise anyone. But I really like the defense that Tyrone Taylor brings and how he contributes to this team. And I also think Jeff is growing more comfortable out there. So I think for me, at least, the bar to improve center field has probably risen over the past, let's say, 2 weeks, because of maybe Jeff's comfort level a little bit more out there, and also continuing to recognize the secondary skills that Tyrone can provide. So that's the obvious position, and I understand that. I'm certain we're going to be engaged, but we got to clear a bar that we actually think makes us better, given the price that I think these things are going to cost.
So that answer is telling you it is unlikely the Mets are adding a bat. That's his answer. It's not impossible, because you'll be engaged. You'll see. You never know who becomes available. but it's unlikely. So I half agree with him, half disagree with him. I agree about Jeff McNeil. I brought this up on the last Rico. I think he's played a really solid center field. He's obviously hit, but he's played a really solid center field, and Tyrone Taylor is wonderful defensively. Taylor is not a guy I want to see starting most of the time, but he's a good caddy for Jeff McNeil. You know, late in the game, after McNeil plays the first six or seven innings in center field, whether it's McNeil moving back to second or just McNeil coming out of the game, Tyrone Taylor coming in late for defense, fantastic, it works. Where I disagree with him is he says there's a higher bar in terms of improving in center field. What I would say is you now can improve at another position. It doesn't have to be center field. Hypothetically, and I'm trying to think of a name that would jump out at me on this. There really isn't. But if you were able to add a good bat, an upgrade bat at second base, there's nothing wrong with that. Because now Jeff McNeil becomes more of a permanent center fielder. If you could add a bat at third base, same thing. So, and DH is the other one that's so easy. Like, if the Mets traded for Suarez, and I don't think they will, but let's say they did. He's your DH. I mean, call it a day. I think Suarez would basically replace Mark Vientos. It basically, you'd be saying, you know what? We're giving up on you. Beatty's going to play third base. Suarez is the everyday DH. Occasionally, Suarez can play third base. McNeil could play center field or second base. Like, I think there are ways now for the Mets to improve their offense without it just being strictly center field. Because here's the point he's making. Let's take Cedric Mullins. Cedric Mullins is having a terrible year. He's going to look at Cedric Mullins. We're all going to look at Cedric Mullins and say, is that really an upgrade over what the Mets are doing right now in center field? I don't think you have to view it that way. I think you could just view it as, is there a bat that improves this lineup? This team has enough flexibility. Well, we can make that bat work. That's at least the way I would look at it.
Carlos described this period as sort of an evaluation period for some of the guys that you have in the bullpen, particularly the guys who have kind of gone back and forth between AAA and the big leagues. How would you evaluate the job that they've done so far?
We put those guys in tough spots. I mean, those are not easy jobs. You're on a plane at 6 a.m. You show up here sometimes for the first time, and we throw you right in a game at 7 p.m. And it's tough, and we've had to do that more than I would like over the past 2-3 weeks for sure. Some of that is because of injuries. Some of that because we haven't pitched very well at times, and we've needed fresh arms. But those are tough jobs, and I think those guys have performed admirably in sometimes very difficult situations.
I think the one audition reliever who's proving he should stick despite kind of an off night on Monday is Chris Devinsky. Everyone else is gone. And then they come back and then they're gone again. That was David Stearns' nice way of saying they've mostly sucked, but it's our fault because we put them in a tough spot.
Seen, you know, any sort of markets start to heat up, you know, are teams waiting until they kind of, you know, figure out where they are in the standings for?
There are conversations. And so that's normal for 10 days out. It's also normal that it often doesn't get really serious until 2 or 3 days out as you get closer to the deadline. But there's industry conversation going on now for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the conversation's going on, but I think this is part of the problem, and I expect this to change with the new CBA. The trade deadline needs to be moved back because you have teams, including Arizona, who we all talk about as like the really appealing sell team. The Diamondbacks right now are 5 games out of a playoff spot. This is a team that went to a World Series 2 years ago. Are they in a rush to sell? Like, they're kind of on the fence. Like, if they have a 5-game winning streak this week and now they're 2 games out at the trade deadline, are they going to sell? So I think what would make things easier and let the market be clearer is to have this trade deadline be August 15th. And long-term prediction, it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen after the next CBA. But as far as now is concerned, it's July 22nd. As we record this, we got 9 days before the deadline. There's some obvious sellers, but there's a lot of teams that are on the fence because they're looking at the standings saying, I'm not sure what we should do.
You mentioned the offense in center field, but overall the depth of the lineup hasn't probably been as productive as you'd hoped over the last month or so. Is that something that you think can be fixed internally, or is that something that needs to be addressed as well?
So I might push back on that a little bit. I actually think the depth of our lineup over the last couple of weeks has been pretty good. We're turning the lineup over pretty nicely, I think. We have guys at the bottom of our lineup who are extending at bats, seeing pitches. I think the fair critique is we haven't scored runs. We've taken pretty good at bats. We're getting guys on base, and we haven't scored runs. And that goes back to a theme that we've talked about a lot here, which is getting those hits and executing with runners in scoring position, which has been a challenge for us all year. I don't have the answer for that. I wish I did. We'd have solved it. But I actually think the length of our lineup has been pretty good over the last, say, 2 to 4 weeks.
That answer, whether we all disagree with it or not, and I do, tells you they're not adding a bat. Like, the earlier answer told you they're unlikely to add a bat. That puts it over the top, because what David Stearns is telling you, and it's sort of backed up by numbers, is we're not scoring enough runs, but the reason we're not scoring enough runs is we're just not getting big hits, and there's nothing we could do to change that. We're just going to sit back and wait. Like, their OPS is fourth in the National League. Their OPS plus is fourth in the National League. They have hit the fourth best amount of home runs. So their numbers indicate they should have a top four offense in the National League, but the results are not the case. They have the ninth best offense in the National League. And so David Stearns is telling you it's not the length of the lineup. It's that we're not getting big hits. And there's no trade that's necessarily going to change that. I think the length of the lineup can be improved. I would be open to doing so. Now, I agree. It's not just anybody. It has to be the right guy that you look at and say, okay, this makes our lineup better. And like we talked about, there aren't a lot of superstars available. It's not like Yoenis Cespedes is walking through that door. But that answer tells you he doesn't look at offense as a priority. So if you're holding your breath or you're asking for the Mets to add a bat, don't expect it. I'd be surprised based on these answers.
David, almost every contender has had an extended slump this year. We're seeing the Dodgers, the Tigers, the Astros. Only one team has 60 wins. Do you have a theory as to why no one separated themselves yet? And does it make for a tougher deadline when there's so many teams jammed up near the top of near the top of the game?
I don't know whether it's the fact that every contender has had slips. I don't know if that's abnormal. I think I thought I saw Mr. Torrey somewhere here. Maybe except for the 98, Mr. Torrey. Maybe except for the 98 Yankees. I think the mortal teams. Have slips. Even the really good mortal teams have slips. So I don't know whether that's unusual. The deadline this year does feel a little bit more clumped, where there are teams that are trying to figure out now 10 days out which way they're going to go. But even over the next, let's say, week, I imagine that will separate as well.
There are no great teams. I mean, to answer that question, there's a lot of mediocrity in baseball. It's not a bad thing. It means there's great competitive balance, as much as everyone cried about the Dodgers and what they were doing in the offseason. But I think the separation between the very best team in baseball and a borderline playoff team is not that high. I mean, we don't pay attention to the flaws that the Tigers have or the Phillies have or the Cubs have or what we do, the Yankees. There's a lot of flaws. There's a lot of flawed teams. I think that's the answer.
Hey, David, so then at third base, whether it's a timeshare or somebody outright claiming that position, is it fair to say that you anticipate the group that you have, for the most part, being the people that you rely on for that position in the second half the rest of the way?
That would be my expectation.
Another example of do not expect this team to add a bat.
Just, is there another move for Garcia today as well?
So Rico is not here. We claimed Rico. He's not here. So he'll report, and I imagine that'll happen over the next day or so.
Rico Garcia making his return after I jinxed him on a Rico about a week and a half ago. He had pitched well, then the Mets DFA'd him. It's possible that Kevin Hergett, who they just claimed and was a hero in the opener of this series against the Angels, gets sent out. But the guy that really should be sent out is this Alex Carrillo. I mean, he's a great story, but does he really need to be on the major league roster? But it's good to have Rico back in the fold.
David, just to go back to Jeff for a second, if things play out a certain way, would you be comfortable seeing him getting the bulk of the playing time in center field for the next couple of months?
I think I'd be comfortable with the type of distribution we presently have. Some of that is because I think we've seen Jeff get a little bit more comfortable out there. And so if we continue to see that type of progress, I'd be comfortable with that.
I'm comfortable with it. I think he's their best option right now in center field. And I actually wouldn't have an issue with him playing center field basically every single day. But if you look at recently, because he said, hey, I'm comfortable with the distribution recently. Let me read to you the starting center fielders from Monday's game moving backwards. And you can hear the distribution because I know sometimes it can be confusing because McNeil plays every day. So it's not, oh, Jeff McNeil's not in the lineup, or he is in the lineup. He must be playing center field. He's obviously played a lot of second base. Here is your center field alignment over the last 2 weeks. McNeil, Taylor, McNeil, Taylor, 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 McNeil, Taylor, McNeil, Taylor, 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 McNeil, McNeil, Taylor, McNeil, Taylor, McNeil, McNeil, Taylor, Taylor, McNeil. So I don't love that distribution, to be quite frank with you. Like, I want more McNeil. We haven't seen Jeff McNeil start back-to-back games in center field since the end of June. Have we seen him play three straight games in center field? The answer is no. In fact, I'm looking through this whole chart. The only time he's played back-to-back games in center field were two examples, June 29th to July 2nd. I think there was a rainout. That's why it feels like it was so separated, but it was back-to-back games. And then June 24th and June 25th against Atlanta. Other than that, he doesn't play back-to-back games in center field. I disagree with that. So if David Stern says he's comfortable with the current alignment, that means he's comfortable with Tyrone Taylor playing center field 65 to 70% of the time. I got no problem with McNeil playing center field every day and then Taylor coming into games late.
David, you raised the possibility, if things break a certain way, of using your AAA pitching prospects at this level at some point this season. Do you have any of your position player prospects that you feel the same way about?
I think on the position player side, more likely than not, it's the grouping that we've seen here. I think it's the grouping of our veterans and then the younger players who we've seen throughout. Right now, I think it's probably less likely that we see the position player prospect make an impact.
Yeah, so the position player prospect I was thinking about the other day in terms of need and in terms of performance, and I have not heard his name mentioned as a guy that would be called up, and it's not Jett Williams, because Jett Williams is still playing a lot of shortstop, a lot of second base, a little bit of center field, not a lot. I doubt that they're comfortable with him playing center field at the major league level. Is actually their first-round pick from a year ago, Carson Bench, who started the year this year in Brooklyn. Got called up to AA, I guess, about a month ago. And so far in AA, is hitting .345, two home runs, 1,000 OPS, but it's only 16 games. Now, he was the first-round pick a year ago. He's 22 years old. He went to college. We've seen guys get the call that quick. Not necessarily from the Mets, but we've seen it before. So Benj getting the call wouldn't be that abnormal if you look around Major League Baseball. But it doesn't sound like David Stearns has that appetite. What's appealing about this is that he's a center fielder. Like, it fits kind of the need. So of all the position player prospects, and the Mets have called up, obviously, Ronnie Mauricio, we forget, you know, even though we got that cup of coffee a year and a half ago, still a position player prospect upon being called up. But Benj was the guy I was thinking about, but probably not something the Mets would do. I guess it would take a lot of injuries or something to do that. And he's only played 16 games in AA. I get it. But you look around baseball, we've seen guys get the call in that type of quick fashion before.
This is a little bit of an industry-wide question, but it pertains specifically to you guys with Clay Holmes and his workload. A little bit of a unique situation because he was a reliever for a long time. Yeah. But you guys are far from the only contender with an important starting pitcher who's, you know, gone way over his innings from the previous year or career-high innings or whatever. It seems that there used to sort of be a – you know, an industry standard of like how many innings each year incrementally. And it seems like that's kind of changed, at least in the conversation. What are the things that that you guys and other teams are looking at with pitchers like that? And how much has that conversation changed about how much a pitcher can increase his workload from 1 year to the next?
I think the reason why it's changed a little bit and we don't look at that either percentage increase or fixed innings increase is because it wasn't working. Guys were still getting hurt and it didn't appear to be particularly effective. I don't know that we've got it figured out now, where clearly guys are pitchers are still getting hurt. I don't necessarily think it's because of workload increases. I think there might be some other dynamics there, but I think more and more we're trying to treat each pitcher as an individual. And if a pitcher feels good, both subjectively and objectively, we try not to artificially shut them down. Clay, in his case, is a veteran. I think he's very honest with our performance staff and our medical staff. And so there's a lot of communication back and forth to ensure that we're doing everything we can to keep him in a good spot.
No perfect science to this. The innings limit was annoying because it felt arbitrary. At least now, even if it isn't perfect, communicating with your pitcher, seeing if his mechanics change, that's probably the best way to analyze someone who's making a big jump in innings pitch. You know, another guy making a big jump in innings pitch is Senga, because he didn't pitch last year. So he's also making a pretty big jump.
Last year, and even in 18 in Milwaukee, when you went to the NLCS, your team didn't have kind of the prototypical number one or shutdown starter. I'm wondering how valuable in the current landscape that player is compared to maybe prior generations, and whether we kind of overinflate it in the popular imagination.
I still think it's really valuable, and there have been teams in that I've been around in my career that have had one or multiple ace level starters on their staff and got bounced early in the playoffs and is tough. You know, that can be tough to figure out sometimes too. So you'd always like to have, the horse at the front of the rotation. There's no question, but it's not the only way to build a rotation. It's not the only way to win a playoff series. It's not the only way to win a World Series. I think we have multiple pitchers on our staff right now, in that grouping of five, who can lead a staff into a playoff series. I'm confident of that. I'm comfortable with that. We need to keep building those guys up. We need to keep those guys healthy. But I think from a talent perspective, we have guys on our staff right now that can lead us into a postseason series.
In theory, we do. Because in theory, despite Senga's bad outing on Monday, he's been mostly really good as a major leaguer. Sean Manaea, as a New York Met, even in the first half before he made that arm angle change, has been really good. David Peterson, for the last calendar year, has been really good. Do they qualify as aces? Probably not. But mainly it's because what's an ace? And how many aces are there in Major League Baseball? Like a true, absolute ace. Like, there's only a few that jump out at me. Tarik Skubal and Zach Wheeler. Those are the two that just jump out at me as, hey, no debate, move on, they're aces. There are not many. Is Max Fried an ace? Now, Max Fried's been pretty damn good. He's close. He probably is. I'd say Fried's in that conversation. But it's a very short list in terms of true top-of-the-rotation aces.
You mentioned the possibility of shortening up your AAA guys. But obviously, like, you want to be sure that they're going to be relievers at that point. I guess just with Sproat and McClain, just given their AAA numbers, is there a desire to get them here at some point this year to, you know, see what they can do?
I don't think we have to. I think it for any prospect, it's a combination of where they are in their developmental progression and where the team need is. Both those guys, I think, over the last 3 weeks have taken meaningful steps forward in their development. And I'm excited to see where it goes from here. And if there is a need, I think either of those guys could be ready over the next couple months.
They should have used them in the last month instead of having to watch these bullpen games. I'm mixed because I hope they're not up here in the rotation because that means there are injuries. We talked about earlier the idea of them being shortened up and being used out of the bullpen. But right now, the Mets have a five-man rotation. And at least for the next 3.5 to 4 weeks, they don't need a sixth starter. And once they do need a sixth starter, there's a chance Paul Blackburn is just going to fill that role. So as intrigued as I am by seeing Brandon Sproat up here, ideally, it's not as a starter at this point because that means there would be more injuries. One last question for the president, David Stearns.
Since we are 10 days out, I'm just curious if, given high payrolls for small market teams, have any of them been calling you kind of using a variation of the old Hedy Youngman line, take my players, please, just to...
No, I think... No, the answer is no. I think teams are trying to win right now. If anything, I've gotten the opposite from certain teams that some sellers would be more open to paying down a player to get better prospect return than having other teams take the money. So I have not gotten that impression.
Two questions that were not asked of David Stearns that I wish were. And maybe the next time he meets the media, though, that'll be after the trade deadline, so it's meaningless. But two questions I'd have been curious about. One, David Robertson. Hey, were you guys, we know you watched him. Did you make an offer? Like, what was your interest level in David Robertson before signing with the Phillies? And the second question, and it's something we've talked a lot about on the Rico and we've talked about on the Fan, is, hey, David, would you be open to moving Clay Holmes to the bullpen if you acquired a starting pitcher? Or would you be open to moving him to the bullpen as opposed to the young arms? You know, we talked and he talked about Sproat or McClain being used and shortened up as relievers. Well, the other option is to have them enter the rotation and shorten up Clay Holmes. So I would have loved to at least hear his comments on the idea of doing that with Clay, at least temporarily. Like, I wouldn't be giving up on the Clay Holmes starting experiment. I think he's had a pretty good year, but in terms of what best fits this team down the stretch, is that a possibility? Unfortunately, it was never asked. But good stuff from David Stearns. We appreciate it. Any comments, any opinions on what the president had to say, you can, of course, email us, therico@gmail.com, therico@gmail.com. We'll have a Rico recap of this series against the Angels coming up at some point Wednesday night after the series ends. And on Thursday, our big trade deadline preview. We appreciate you listening, subscribing, and downloading another edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.